Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to a lady who has redefined courage and reset modern medical boundaries time and time again. Janine Shepherd was a champion cross-country skier, bound for the Winter Olympics to represent Australia. Then in 1996, Janine accepted an invitation to join a bike ride where one life was to be destroyed and another to begin. We're proud to welcome Janine Shepherd to Open House Around Australia. Janine, thank you for your time. Let's reset the clock to that morning where you suit up, climb on board your push bike for that tour through the Blue Mountains.
Yeah, you make it sound like a nice little, you know, casual ride. It wasn't exactly like that. We were training. I was in the Australian ski team. So I knew it was going to be a hard ride. And we were riding from Sydney up to the Blue Mountains, which is something that I did with my fellow teammates every year. We called it the Rooster Ride, and it took about 6 hours. So, you know, it was a training session.
Do you remember what was going through your mind at the time that the accident took place?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is that I wasn't actually going to go on the ride that day because I'd been overtraining, so I was quite tired, and I'd had some blood tests just to find out what the cause was. So I had decided that I wasn't going to go on the ride, but a friend in the team was coming up from Victoria and convinced me to go, so I thought, fair enough, I'll go. And I just remember going up the hill in the Blue Mountains, Boddington Hill, Wentworth Falls, and thinking, I'm really tired. I'd just dropped off the pace a bit. I was the only girl on the ride, so it was probably 20 guys on the ride. And I was just dropping to the back of the pack because I was just really starting to struggle in terms of, you know, getting enough oxygen and, you know, and I was just, you know, really, really tired and fatigued. So I just remember thinking, gee, I'm glad this ride's almost over.
And then you were hit by a speeding utility truck. What do your friends and family and fellow cyclists tell you what happened in those next few hours and days?
Yeah, well, it was pretty horrific hearing it from their side. But apparently that there was a car driving past. They saw something flying through the air, and that was me. So that car stopped, ran back, just as a few people. The guy that hit me did eventually stop. And a couple of guys were about to pick me up and throw me in a car to take me to hospital, but of course that would have been it for me if they had moved me. And a lady ran down and stopped them, and she just sat by my side and held my hand. Apparently I was thrashing about violently. My helmet was off. There was blood everywhere, and my clothes were ripped, and my bike was smashed on the side of the road somewhere. And apparently I was thrashing about trying to sit up, but of course I couldn't. And, you know, stuff was coming out of my mouth and my eyes were glazed and, you know, it wasn't a very nice sight. And apparently another lady came down and took one look at me and was sick. So,
goodness.
You know, it was pretty horrific. So then someone called an ambulance. The ambulance came, cut some clothes off, put me in the back of the ambulance up to Katoomba Hospital, and then it was just, you know, everyone head down, whatever they could do to save my life at that point. They, you know, even though I'd broken my neck and back in six places, that wasn't the major concern at that stage. It was the massive internal bleeding that was going to kill me, and they flew me down by rescue helicopter down to Prince Henry Hospital in Sydney.
So for the next 10 days, you drift in and out of consciousness, but you clearly recall choosing living over letting go.
Yeah, I knew I was dying. It's, you know, it's so difficult because everyone always says, you know, what's it like? You know, what's a near-death experience like? And I thought, it was a death experience.
Yes.
But it was a very painful and a dark place in many ways. I mean, I just had this recollection of knowing that I was dying and not wanting to go, like thinking, well, this, you know, I knew that the option of not going back to my body was just so much nicer, and that, you know, as I was sort of in between two dimensions, it was almost as if there was one part in intensive care, you know, just in the most excruciating pain, which I cannot even describe to people what it was like, and then another part that was just sort of watching, you know, pain-free, saying, you know, just let go. Just let go. And, you know, it was like being in a tug of war. That's the only way I can explain it. Like two people, one person on one side and one person on the other. And at the time I didn't know it, but my parents were sitting by my bed. My father sat by my bed that whole time holding my hand. And I really feel like that was my lifeline. You know, it was like I didn't want to come back because my body was so broken. But, you know, it was as if something was holding me to this life. You know, it was like this anchor that was just, that wouldn't let me go. You know, there were times when, as I was drifting in and out, that he went down to that little chapel on the, oh, I'm going to cry now, but he had, there was a little chapel at Prince Henry Hospital, and Dad, who passed away just over a year ago now, he went down to the chapel and he used to pray for me, and he used to say, just give her my strength. I don't need it. Just give it to her. And I really feel, for me, that was my lifeline.
What an incredibly lonely but powerful image that is of your dad praying in that chapel.
It was, yeah, it was incredible. And what's even more painful is when he passed away just a year and a half ago, he had a stroke and he was left paralyzed in hospital. So it was really bizarre. And I was the one that actually sat by him and said, you gave me your strength back then, Dad, but I'm okay now. You need it. So, you're okay to go. And it was really really a powerful time in my life.
So you choose life. Mm. Do you remember that moment where you realize you can't feel your feet or your legs?
Well, it was like, it was a nightmare. I just couldn't get my head around it. You know, I kept thinking that they're wrong. They're wrong. You know, they can't be right. And then as I had so many injuries, and they didn't tell me everything at once, because I remember Mum said the doctors had told them, don't tell her everything because she won't be able to take it. So it was like they drip-fed me of, you know, all the list of injuries. You know, one day, you know, you've got this, you've broken this, and then, you know, another week later,
goodness,
oh, but you've broken this too. And
no.
I think as I got stronger and more able to cope with it, you know, it just sort of went, you know, we went along, and I gradually, you know, understood exactly what was going on. It took a long time, though. I mean, I had surgery 6 weeks after the accident. You know, I had really extensive spinal surgery, and they had to go in, and I had the neck and back break in six places. The back break in L1 was what they call a comminuted fracture. So they said to my parents, it was as if you'd trod on a peanut and smashed it into thousands of pieces. So the L1 vertebrae was just completely like a crush fracture. So you can imagine,
goodness,
stepping on a peanut, crushing all the bone lodging in my spinal cord. So that was that. I can remember that period 6 weeks after very clearly, because when they said we're going to have to operate, it was like, what? I just kept thinking, they don't know what they're talking about. No. I'm going to go home. My life will be normal. I'll be back at the Olympics. I'll be, doing all the things I did. And I guess that was all I knew, being an athlete. So I couldn't even get my head around the fact that I was now a person with a disability. It just couldn't be happening to me. It's the sort of thing that happens to someone else. So it took a long time for it to sink in. I think it wasn't until I got home, really, that it hit me. It wasn't until I got home and I realized, you know, I had this body that was, you know, I weighed about 45 kilos. You know, I had a catheter bottle. They said I'd have to use a catheter for the rest of my life. I had no feeling in my legs. I couldn't walk. You know, I think it wasn't until I got home, and suddenly in a hospital I was just like everybody else.
Mm.
But when I got home, I was taken out of that environment. So that's when it really hit me. And that's when I think I had that moment of just really wondering why. Why did I come back? Why did I make this choice? I don't want to be here. I don't want this life.
And I suspect that moment of being disabled, in quotation marks, when you get home, is probably amplified by virtue of the community that you built while you were in hospital with fellow patients in the spinal ward.
Yeah, the funny thing is, when I was in hospital, you know, I could never complain, because the girl next to me was a total quadriplegic. How could I complain? And, you know, that really gave me this sense of connection with all of these people who had become my friends, these people who I never, you know, normally would have had anything to do with. We had nothing in common, and suddenly we had everything in common. And then going home and being around normal, so to speak, people again, made me feel different. And that was really difficult. Suddenly it was as if, wow, I'm a disabled person, you know, and that's when it really hit me. And I realized that, you know, I couldn't just move my leg anymore when I wanted to at will. you know, someone actually emailed me this morning. People think it's being in a wheelchair. It's actually not just, it's not the walking that is the worst part. I mean, they don't realize that spinal cord injuries are just so much more than that. They're just such a devastating and debilitating injury. It's loss of feeling. It's loss of pleasure. It's loss of feeling in your body, right down to, you know, sexual pleasure and bladder and bowel control and, you know, loss of your job. And, you know, I mean, there's so many different layers to a spinal cord injury, and that's what people don't see. So things that they can't see, it's not just physically devastating but emotionally as well.
Tell me about the nurse and the straws.
Well, yeah, there was this incredible moment where, you know, one night, I mean, you can imagine everyone lying on their backs, only looking up at the roof. You can't see anybody, so you form these friendships without being able to see what someone looks like, which is really unique. And I mean, I learned so much about life from that spinal ward. And one of the nurses came in one night with big, you know, packets of plastic straws and put a pile on top of each of us. It was a very small ward, six of us. And we wondered what this was all about. And, you know, he told us to start joining our straws up. You know, when you thread one straw into another and, you know, you make a line of straws. And then he went around and joined, you know, everybody's pile, line of straws up. So it wrapped around the ward and over the top of each of us. And then he said, right, everybody hold on. And so we all, you know, held on to our straws. And he goes, right, now we're all connected.
Wow.
And it was this collective moment of just, you know, what a great metaphor, you know, of just that we were all the same. You know, we were all exactly the same. We had the same fears, we had the same hopes and dreams, and, you know, and we supported each other. You know, there were nights when someone would be in pain and crying, and, you know, it was this incredible moment of just heart-to-heart connection. And just the little things, just talking to each other and being there for each other, even if it was 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, sort of talking across the ward and, are you okay? And so it was just, you know, I call it spirit to spirit. It was, you know, such a deep connection and love for each other. And also empathy, because we were all in this together.
You must have been struggling to redefine the goals in your life now.
Oh, absolutely. I had no idea what I was going to do. I mean, all I knew was using my body to play sport or to run or to ski or whatever it was. And suddenly I had a body that just didn't do what it was meant to do. And it was, you know, an incredibly dark time.
Now, at about this time, as you are dealing with the depression and the loss and the isolation and that realization that life is forever so completely different in ways you don't entirely understand, another form of machinery almost pulls you out of depression. We're not talking about a wheelchair here, are we?
No, it was incredible. I mean, I think I got to the point where I realized that, you know, the recognition of knowing that I came back, you know, I had this incredible, despite all of this depression and what was going on around me and this sadness, there was a part of me that just felt this incredible sense of there has to be a reason for this. There has to be a purpose behind this. I made the choice to come back, so I'm going to find out why. I need to know why, you know. And I think there was this letting go of just struggling and wanting to, you know, wanting to love life again, wanting to be a part of life. And it really was at that point when I sort of let go and made that decision that I would, okay, I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to find something to replace everything I'd lost. And it was in that sort of surrender that suddenly my eyes were opened and my mind was opened. And, you know, sitting in my wheelchair, an aeroplane flew over my house and I literally looked up and thought, well, okay, that's it. If I can't walk, then I might as well fly. And that changed my life forever.
Who did you share that thought with and what was their reaction?
Oh, Mum. You know, Mum, I'm going to learn to fly. And she's like, oh, it's nice to you. Nice cup of tea. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was crazy. I'd never wanted to fly in my life. And suddenly it was just, you know, again, I was able to then, you know, be the athlete again in a different way. You know, I realized then that, you know, I might not, my goal of going to the Olympics, my goals, all the things that I'd done all my life were gone, but the things that I valued were still the same. You know, I valued challenge and I valued learning and growth and all of those things, and I could still I could still access those things. It was just going to look a bit different, but, you know, I was still had all the things inside of me that you know, instead of driving me towards the Olympics, were now going to drive me towards becoming a pilot.
So share with us that first flying lesson.
Well, the first one, you know, I was covered in a plaster body cast and they drove me out to the airport and carried me into the flying school. So, you know, it was, I think they just looked at me and thought, you know, she's got to be kidding.
Yeah.
They lifted me into the airplane and, you know, we took off, the instructor and my friend in the back, and we took off over the training area at Bankstown Airport. And, you know, I was just so excited. At that stage, I really didn't even know if it was possible. I just wanted to fly. I just wanted to experience flight. And it was such a great metaphor for the freedom. You know, I couldn't walk. I couldn't use my legs, but that didn't matter. I could fly. And he let me take the controls that day. And ironically, you know, we happened to head towards the Blue Mountains, which is where, you know, I'd had my accident. So, you know, he let me fly around a little bit and, you know, we landed that day and he waved goodbye and thought he'd never see me again. But that was it. I had a goal then and I was determined. And, I didn't know how I'd do it, or I just knew that I was going to do it. So I got the books I'd need to study for my basic aeronautical knowledge, which was back then, and just started studying and just took one day at a time and thought, okay, got to get rid of the wheelchair. You know, that's the first thing. Got to start walking around the house, you know, and had a little exercise routine, and people would hold me up and help me walk. And, you know, I had to get rid of my catheter and get a portable one and learn how to do all those sort of things, which, you know, it was huge, but it was just, I was so excited. You know, it was just, you know, we all have a passion. We all have this, you know, incredible passion that when we find the thing that, you know, ignites that, you know, we don't need, that's our motivation to keep going. And, you know, I was just in love with flying and in love with flight. And that was what kept me going.
Now, you're not only after a private pilot's license just to do circuits and touch and goes, you decide you're going to be an instructor.
Well, yeah, well, one step at a time. First, I got my private license and unrestricted and learned to navigate flying around Australia. And then I got my commercial pilot's license, my instrument rating, my instructor rating and twin engine rating, and got a job teaching other people how to fly. And then I learned to fly upside down and became an aerobatics flying instructor. So, and that was less than 18 months after I'd left the spinal ward. So it was all, you know, just such an incredible journey.
Janine, this is astonishing. I'm a private pilot. I know how difficult it is to get your instrument ratings and then to do your cross-country navigations and then your night flights and then your endorsements on multi-engined aircrafts, let alone aerobatics, which is so physically demanding on its own. This is an Everest for a person whose first flight has them in a body cast. And a catheter. I'm having a hard time getting my head around how you've taught yourself to walk. How much independence physically have you taught yourself to recover during this process? Give me we know you're in a cast on day one.
What happened?
How are you doing this?
Nobody seems to know, but I really put a lot of it down to just incredible willpower and determination. I was so determined to achieve this goal. It was, and you've got to remember that I didn't have anything else. I couldn't finish. I was in my last year at university when it happened, so I couldn't go back. So every single moment of my day was, you know, just flying. Everything I would, you know, I had so many operations, mind you. In that time, I had tendon transfers on my legs and my toes cut and pinned and all sorts of things, you know, back in hospital with infections and on medication and in and out of hospital the whole time. But that's all I had, and it was what, you know, it kept me going. It just, you know, I was just in love with it, and I just, all I wanted to do was to fly and to fly and fly, and every moment I had, I was out at the airport flying and learning and growing and overcoming. You know, it was just that everything became, before my accident, it was all about all the outside things, and now it was like this inner journey where I was really learning about myself and what I was able to do and achieve. In terms of not just physically, but more mentally. It was, you know, I look at my recovery and I go, it was, you know, 10% physical, but 90% mental. Being able to just keep going, being able to stay motivated and on task, and all the skills that I needed to be resilient and to get up and to, you know, despite the pain and the surgery and the setbacks and, the looks from other people at the way I walked. You know, they call it, you know, there's a word that's around that people are talking about, very popular lately, called neuroplasticity. A man called Dr. Norman Doidge wrote a book about that called The Brain That Changes Itself. And that's what I've been able to do. I've, you know, along this process, you've got to remember I was an elite athlete before my accident, so I had a very extensive knowledge of my body and how it worked. And I used to visualize all the time in, you know, as an athlete. So my life became, I was absolutely focused on getting back on my feet and not just learning to walk, but learning to recover to the highest level that I could. So every moment I had, I would be lying. I used to imagine myself walking. I used to lie in bed and imagine my legs walking, my legs moving, my body moving. And what I've been able to do is, I think what I've done is being able to rewire my brain so that there are many muscles in my legs that I don't have. You know, I can't stand up on my toes. I don't have calf muscles and hamstrings and glutes and things like that. But the muscles that I do have are incredibly strong, and they do the function of the ones that I don't have. And my both of my legs are different. I've had different surgery on both legs, and they move in different weird ways. And, you know, I can't push and do things the normal way that people do, but I've learned how to compensate.
Let's roll the clock forward. You marry Janine, and you become a mum, something doctors tell you is never going to happen. You prove them wrong, unsurprisingly. And now you find 6 years after that Blue Mountains bike ride, you have an untreated broken arm.
Well, that was a, you know, funny episode, because I had this really sore arm, and, you know, I went to the doctor three times saying maybe we should have an x-ray, it's a stress fracture, and, you know, no, it's probably just strained. And it was 6.5 years after my accident when we found out that my right arm was still broken, and all the flying that I'd done, particularly in an aerobatic airplane, were just pulling really heavy g-forces,
yes.
So you're really pulling back with that arm. I'd done with a broken arm, and, you know, I say to people, it's amazing. I had to go back and have more surgery, but, you know, I say it's just amazing what, you know, what you can put up with when you've got a goal, when you've got a focus. And I have a really high pain threshold.
Clearly.
I mean, I live with chronic pain, but, you know, the way I explain it to people, it's almost like, you know, you've got the radio on in the background. You know, you've turned it down really low.
Yeah.
And I know that that's just what I have to live with, and I just get on with my life. I just, you know, there's so much I want to do. There's so many incredible experiences to have in this life that I don't want to miss out on any of them. So, you know, I do what I do to cope with that, but I'm not going to let it stop me living my life.
Janine, your incredibly optimistic life view notwithstanding. You live with extreme pain even today, and yet your diary is full. You're a highly sought-after motivational speaker. You are a keen pursuer of spinal research. You've written 3 books. Your life's become a movie for obvious reasons. You at one time were the youngest female board member of the Civil Aviation Authority, and a mum 3 times over, something that doctors yet again told you you'd never be able to achieve. Of all of those many life lessons, which one do you hold dearest?
So difficult to pick one lesson. I think, you know, a lot of people probably would look at me and go, well, you know, that's okay. She's, you know, she's an athlete. She's, you know, she probably had those skills. And in a sense, I did. I did have a lot of skills that have helped me. But despite that, I've had to work, and I still do work every single day on myself to maintain the level of hope and optimism that I have. I think I'm a high hope thinker. You know, I have a lot of hope in my life. But I work on it really hard. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that you do, you know, I just get up every day. I mean, I have bad days. I have really bad days.
Still?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody does. You know, I mean, I have my 3 kids. I've got amazing kids, and I, you know, they know better than anyone that, you know, my little saying is, you know, be happy when you're happy and sad when you're sad, because there are times when it's completely appropriate to be sad. So, you know, I'm certainly not a Pollyanna, you know, every day running around going, you know, life's great. I mean, life is great, but, you know, there are really some sad things that happen in life, and there are some sad moments, and we need to honour those moments. So I think I have a really good balance, but I also think that being positive and being happy is a skill that needs to be learnt, needs to be cultivated. And, I often in my talks, I talk a lot about resilience and how we cultivate the skills of resilience, and they are you know, that are qualities that we can learn, and, you know, most importantly, we actually learn to be resilient in the context of people that we're around. So my children are incredibly resilient thinkers. And that has a lot to do with just the fact that they've watched me all their lives.
Janine, what do you have for somebody living through life-altering grief or loss right now?
Is to never, ever let other people tell you what you can or you can't do. Live, you know, define your own limits. Don't let other people do it for you. And to never give up, because, you know, I have this, it's just my belief that everything happens for a reason. And everything that happens is there to teach us something. There's some jewel, some gift in every single adversity that we're going through. And you will find it one day. And I look back now and I know that I can honestly say that my accident was the best thing that happened to me. Wouldn't have said it at the time, but I can now, because it's given me a perspective on life and an ability to really be compassionate and loving towards other people, and I wouldn't swap that for anything in the world.
In summation, let us in on the Wings for Life World Run coming up shortly.
Well, it's a fantastic initiative. I'm actually ambassador for the Spinal Cure Australia, which, of course, I believe that, you know, finding a cure for spinal cord injury isn't a matter of if, it's a matter of when. But, of course, we need money to keep research going around the world, and they've had some amazing advances in spinal work around the world. Red Bull, the owner of Red Bull, has a friend whose son is in a wheelchair, and he decided that money needed to be put into this. So he started a charity called Wings for Life, and they've put on a fantastic event in May this year called the World Run, which is incredibly creative and a lot of fun. In fact, it's a running race that has no finish line. So around the world, in different countries around the world, it starts at exactly the same time. Doesn't matter what country you're in, it's the same time. So I think in London it's like 11 a.m, and in Australia, in Busselton, Western Australia, it's 6 p.m. at night. Everybody starts at the same time. If you're running at night, you wear a head torch, and everybody takes off, and then half an hour after the runners start, a car takes off and starts driving slowly, and you're out when the car catches you. And then there's a final winner for each country, and then, of course, there's a world ring winner measured on distance. And 100% of the entry fee goes towards spinal research.
What a great idea.
It's a fantastic, creative, fun idea.
Yeah.
I love the fact that it's raising awareness, because the thing about spinal injuries is it's probably everybody's worst nightmare. You know, the thought of lying, waking up and being paralyzed in a spinal ward, I can't tell you how many people say to me, no way, I wouldn't want to be alive. So I say, well, you know, we can't deny the fact that it's incredibly confronting, and a lot of people don't want to think about it, but we need to keep that awareness up. We need to keep talking about it and keep the conversation going, because this is a devastating illness. Injury.
Janine Shepherd, you make me want to be more active, but a better bloke. Thanks so much for joining us on Open House.
It's just a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
JanineShepherd.com. Check the website and you'll find a whole bunch of other stuff there. And hopefully this won't be the last time we get to spend some time together. Maybe when we get a little bit closer to the Wings for Life World Run, we'll chat again. Would that be okay?
That would be great. I'd love to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Janine.
Okay, bye, Jane.